please. Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and His Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 11-1793, GSS Group LTD, also known as Global Security Services LTD, representing the Court of Authority, Mr. Gerlitz, the appellant, and the appellant for the appellate.
Good morning, Your Honors. Thank you. Stanley McDermott for the appellant. There are three issues presented this morning. The first, the major issue, whether National Port Authority of Liberia is entitled to due process protections. There are, however, two subordinate, closely related issues. The first being, what would the due process standard be if, in fact, the NPA were entitled to constitutional due process protections? The second, what is the true relationship between the National Port Authority and Liberia? In other words, is it the agent, the closely controlled agent of Liberia, in which event the question would be moot in accordance with this Court's prior decisions in Price, TMR, and the Second Circuit's opinion in Frontera. In fact, this case is sort of the fourth in the progression of cases, one might say, starting with Price, going through TMR, getting to Frontera. I would like to address first the due process standard, because I think this moots the larger question of whether the NPA would be entitled to due process at all. If it is entitled to due process, for the sake of argument, the standard, the appropriate due process standard, is notice and fair opportunity to be heard. And that is embedded in the FSIA. And the major point here is that what this case concerns is a petition to enforce an arbitration award that has already established the NPA's liability and its damages. An arbitration award is a de facto judgment in this context. A petition to confirm the award is tantamount to a petition to enforce a judgment. And that being the case, the due process standard, should there be one, is not minimum contacts, but rather notice an opportunity to be heard.
Do you want to address the issue of whether this was raised in a timely fashion below, that argument?
The issue was raised in a timely fashion below for two reasons. Number one,
besides a Rule 59 motion, where else was it raised?
The issue of the right of the NPA to a constitutional due process defense.
No, the particular argument you're raising now, which is the kind of due process defense it would have.
It was specified for the most part in the Rule 59 motion. The explanation of Schaffer, the full explanation of why the appropriate due process standard was spelled out, for the most part in the 59 motion.
What other part is there?
Well, I think it was embedded in the very notion of whether or not there is a due process right at all. If there was
How can that be?
Well, I think if there's...
I mean, you're talking about what the due process... What is due process? Notice and an opportunity to be heard. But you argued the case, both sides argued the case on the basis of minimum contacts, didn't you? Either you have no due process right at all, or it's a minimum contact.
Yes, I think that's correct, Your Honor. But when the district court in its original decision said that,
I have to correct myself. You did not argue about the sufficiency of the context. Your only claim was that NPA does not have any due process rights.
That's correct. Okay. And when the district court decided the first decision, we then filed the Rule 59 motion specifying in far more detail this point, that in fact, if there is a due process right, one must confront what the due process standard is. And I think that question is intertwined inextricably in whether or not there should be a due process right to begin with. But having said that, the district court clearly was aware of the point, and it addressed the point in ruling in the second opinion on the Rule 59E motion, saying that
the same opinion said that the issue had been not been raised originally and that that was a sufficient ground for rejecting it.
Yes, but then the court then did proceed.
How do we review that conclusion? Let's say, do we review that de novo or deferentially?
Yeah, like the Rule 59E standard is the court should hear and adjudicate any question that would change the outcome. That otherwise represents a clear error of law, manifest injustice, or would alter the outcome.
I thought we reviewed for abuse of discretion.
You do review for abuse of discretion, but it is per se an abuse of discretion if a issue of law would change the outcome. And I think
so are you saying then that in every case a party can who has two arguments in its favor can save the second one for the Rule 59 motion, and if the district court says too late that is an error of law?
I think so, when the case is in its incipient stages, such as this case was, when we're dealing with a threshold motion to dismiss, when the merits of the case have not been addressed.
Is there any case that's held that a district court that says waiting until the Rule 59E motion is too late is an abuse of discretion?
Well, I think there's no specific case, but the abuse of discretion standard, is implicated if, in fact, there is a clear error of law.
Error of law depends on what issues have been raised, right?
Yes, I think that's correct. But I also think you must recognize that the district court itself recognized that this was, in fact, an argument that it should address, and it did address it, and it said
you don't want to be in, do you? Do you want to take us to a position where if a judge thinks that an issue has been waived, but just to cover all bets, he addresses it, that means that his finding of waiver is or forfeiture is canceled or of no account?
No, I wouldn't go that far, but I would invite.
Produce terrible results, wouldn't it?
Possibly, but I would invite the court to what the district court says at page 9 of his second opinion. He says, quote, even assuming that one or more of these arguments is persuasive, then they were not properly presented. My point is this: if it is an argument which is, as the district court itself admits, persuasive.
No. At least the passage you just read says,
possibly.
Let's entertain the assumption that it's persuasive.
Precisely, but that gives it a dimension, I would suggest, that brings it within the Rule 59E standard, which says that if a result is going to be changed, then the court should adjudicate it. And I would suggest that if what is possibly persuasive is, as a matter of law, truly persuasive, then it is error, legal error, for the district court not to hear argument on the point. And that really crystallizes, I think, what our point is. That if you entertain the possibility that it is persuasive to an extent that would change the outcome, then I think it's an error of law not to consider it.
Can I ask you a question on the issue that is indisputably preserved? And that is the relationship between this and TMR. It seems to me that TMR regards, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, Bankcheck, whatever, as providing the template for considering the validity of the exercise of the federal courts of jurisdiction over state-owned corporations, state-owned instrumentalities, to put it more broadly, and applied that concept in TMR itself. If that's correct, how can you win, given Banchek's allusion to a presumption that a sovereign state's decision to separate an instrumentality from itself should normally be accepted?
Well, that raises a third point: whether or not Liberia so dominates the NPA that.
Well, that's the other dropped issue. But let's stick to the issue that's clearly not dropped.
Because I don't think TMR holds, certainly the Second Circuit in Frontera doesn't hold, that in fact the only test is the Banseck test in order to determine whether or not there's a constitutional right available to an agency or instrument.
What does TMR mean when it says, we believe the same analysis, referring to Foremost McKesson's adoption of BANCAC, must govern whether the SPF is a person within the meaning of the Due Process Clause?
The price analysis, Your Honor, I think that analysis controls whether or not a principal-agent relationship exists.
You said you didn't think TMR stands for the proposition that we have to apply BANCAC to the issue of personal jurisdiction.
Yes.
And they say we believe the same analysis must govern whether the SPF is a person within the meaning of the Due Process Clause.
Well, because I think you have to reconcile that statement with the footnote that follows, where the court specifically says that it is far from clear that even an independent SPF would be entitled to a constitutional due process right.
That's a different issue. If that footnote were correct, then no foreign corporation would have a due process right. Doesn't say anything. That footnote says nothing about the BANCAC analysis. That is, if that footnote were adopted, we'd throw out the whole issue, and there would just be no right at all, right?
Yeah, but similarly, if that sentence from the opinion describing BANCAC were controlling, then the footnote itself would be moot.
Are you arguing that no foreign corporation has a due process right?
I don't think the court has to go that far.
No, did you argue that?
We did argue that, yes. That's the ultimate issue. I think that issue is frankly rendered moot if the standard that is to be applied is not minimum contact. I would urge the
court. What do you do with the Goodyear opinion by Justice Ginsburg, which was rendered after TMR and specifically says that foreign corporations have a due process right?
Because I think the NPA of Liberia is a different creature.
Well, that's a different question. The question I'm asking you is, how can you possibly maintain that all foreign corporations have no due process right after the Goodyear opinion?
I don't. That is not our position. We do not go that far. There's absolutely no need for this court to go that far in deciding this case.
I had the impression you were arguing that. You're not arguing that at all, then.
Well, the ultimate issue, if you look at TMR, is an agency or instrument.
You would win if the rule were no foreign corporations, state-owned or otherwise, had due process rights.
For an agency or instrumentality, yes.
So you're only restricting your argument to agency or instrumentality. Then.
Yes.
All right. In that case, we have in a sentence which in the full text of the opinion which says. That the BANCAC analysis must govern whether the SPF is a person. And there's a footnote which speculates, does not decide, but speculates about foreign corporations. We, of course, are governed by our precedents. I don't see how we can get around that sentence in the text of the opinion, which is a holding.
Well, as I believe that sentence simply refers to the principal agent test, and it says if the principal agency test is met, then the agency cannot be a person entitled to due process rights. I think that is the meaning of that sentence, which is the reason why we say that if that in fact is dispositive.
Just to do some textual analysis here, that paragraph begins with the sentence. In Foremost McKesson, we held the presumption of independent status detailed in BANCAC also applies to the question of subject matter jurisdiction. And then it goes on and says, we believe the same analysis must govern whether the SPF is a person. That says the presumption is going to apply, doesn't it?
It does indeed. But my point is this: if you look at the footnote that follows, the first sentence of the footnote that says it is far from obvious that even an independent SPF would be entitled to the protection of the Fifth Amendment.
Of course, it is not a footnote to what I was talking about. It's a footnote to the following paragraph.
It is indeed. But if in fact that is the test, principal agent and nothing else. Then our point in this appeal is that the district court was required to adjudicate that question, determine whether, in fact, the NPA of Liberia is a closely controlled agent, precisely under the test announced in that sentence.
But you didn't make that. You didn't present any evidence of that in your opening materials.
Well, we reserved the right to raise the issue. We asked for discovery on the point if it was relevant. We specifically referred to the relevant evidence in the 59E motion. And I suggest it was perfectly timely for us to do so at that point.
Did you file a motion to engage in jurisdictional discovery before your Rule 59E motion?
No.
Yeah.
But the point of the 59E motion, of course, was to attempt to convince the district judge that it should take a step back and allow adjudication on that issue, and if discovery were relevant, to order discovery, as other courts of appeals have directed in similar cases. But I do think that if it's an important issue, which it clearly is, because it would moot the ultimate issue, then it should be adjudicated. And in a case such as this, it is abuse of discretion not to permit the adjudication of an issue which the court itself, the district court itself, says is or would be central to its decision. The district court, in its first opinion, said it was, quote, entirely possible, close quote, that the NPA of Liberia would have been or would be a closely controlled agency, an agent. And if the district court itself, in its opinion, admits that it is entirely possible that that might in fact be the case, then that issue should be adjudicated.
The order that the district court issued dismissing the complaint, is that with prejudice or without prejudice?
Without prejudice, I believe. There was no adjudication of the merits.
So you think you can just file another lawsuit and then make the arguments that you didn't make in the district court but you made in the 59E motion? Is that what you're saying?
Well, it's. I'm not saying that is what has been done, but yes. If in fact there has been a dismissal without an adjudication of the merits, then perhaps that could be raised in a subsequent action. But that's not the course that we've taken, and it's not, I would submit, the course that 59E requires.
Yeah, dismissals can be with prejudice even if they don't, are not based on the merits of the case. You understand that?
Yes, of course.
And I think that was the NPA's motion to dismiss, did they ask for dismissal with prejudice?
I do not know the answer to that, Your Honor. I have to look. I have time reserved, if I may.
Well, we've gone over your time reserved, but since it's our fault, we'll might let you get a little more time when we're finished.
Thank you.
Thank you. From the other side.
Good morning, Your Honors. Jessica Ellsworth on behalf of NPA. With one exception, the issues that GSS seeks to present in this appeal were waived, as the court has noted, by GSS's failure to raise them prior to the Rule 59E motion. The one issue that was properly presented and preserved is whether a federal court can exercise personal jurisdiction over a foreign corporation when that corporation lacks minimum contacts with the United States and is independent of but owned by a foreign sovereign. Judge Friedman correctly held that the answer to that question is no.
I thought the initial issue and the initial claim was that any state-owned corporation, if the government holds 100%, should be considered the state itself and therefore has no due process rights. That was, as I understand it, that's what Judge Friedman thought the claim was.
That's correct, Judge Randolph. That's what GSS argued in response to NPA's motion, was a categorical rule that any state-owned instrumentality was the equivalent of the state for due process purposes.
Right.
That conflicts directly with this court's holding in TMR, in which it said, as Judge Garland has noted, that the BANSEC analysis must govern whether or not the presumption of separateness applies to a state-owned instrumentality. And NPA fits to a T the description of a typical government instrumentality spelled out in BANSEC from the fact that it can sue.
The AMR, what was it? It was some Siberian organization or something?
I believe it was a
Ukrainian
state property fund.
Was that a corporation?
I don't believe it was a corporation. The court found it was the equivalent of a state executive agency of the Ukraine, that it operated under the plenary control of the Ukraine, that it implemented national policy, that it was.
Any cases involving a foreign corporation that was 100% owned by a foreign state?
Well, I mean, in BANSEC, that's one of the characteristics.
No, I'm talking about for this minimum contact personal jurisdiction.
I think the corporation in Frontera may have been. It was a state-owned oil company, and it from Azerbaijan, and I believe it may have been wholly owned, but I'm not positive. One of the characteristics that the Supreme Court identified in BANSEC as setting out a typical government instrumentality is that it is wholly owned by the government, and that the presumption of separateness applies even when that is the case. And in fact, this court in not only TMR Energy, but also in Foremost McKesson and the Transamerica Leasing case have taken great steps to articulate what it takes to overcome that presumption. And it needs to be more than just majority ownership or more than just control and appointment of who sits on a board of directors. And in Transamerica Leasing, this court explained that if that was all it took to establish an agency relationship, then the presumption of separateness would be an illusion because it would never apply, since those are typical characteristics of any state-owned entity.
How do you answer the question raised in the famous TMR footnote?
I think the TMR footnote, if you read just the first clause of it, it suggests that it's far from obvious why an independent state entity. Even an independent state entity. But what the court then goes on to say, if you read past the first clause, is that courts often assume minimum contacts applies to foreign persons.
Yes.
And that
says that. It always seems to have been assumed and not in response to a challenge, right?
Right. But my opposing counsel has made clear he's not challenging the general rule that foreign corporations never receive due process protections, which is what the footnote is questioning. The footnote is sort of looking at the fact there are different strands of constitutional analysis, and the Verdugo case that it cites is a Fourth Amendment case in which the Supreme Court held.
Are you saying then that it's open to, on the sort of set of cases this court has decided, it's open to us to say that the 100% owned, 100% state-owned corporations get the benefit of the BANSEC presumption, and 100% non-state-owned foreign corporations are swept in without any due process rights at all?
No, I think the same analysis governs all foreign corporations, and that's what BANSEC.
I mean, but that takes one back to the first sentence of the footnote, which cites Verdugo or Quiddes and raises the general question, which the district court alluded to, reconciling all this with the general absence of any substantive constitutional rights for foreign persons, broadly conceived.
Well, there are a seminal line of cases setting out the Fifth Amendment due process rights for foreign corporations, for foreign citizens. This court has even held that the minimum contacts analysis applies to bin Laden and al-Qaeda in the Mawani case. That there is a well-established line of cases finding that to be the case. And even
now,
in
the Goodyear, now come back to the Goodyear opinion, which was decided after TMR. I was just looking at it, and Justice Ginsburg says a court may assert general jurisdiction over foreign corporations, and then there's and before that it's a parenthetical, that by foreign the court means not only of another state, but also, quote, foreign country corporations.
Correct, Judge Rand.
As long as there's minimum, when their affiliations with the state are so continuous and systematic as to render them essentially at home, citing International Shoe, I mean, that's a clear statement, and the corporations in Goodyear were foreign corporations.
That's correct.
And even though they were subsidiaries of Goodyear, they were nevertheless foreign corporations.
Right. It follows from the International Shoe, Asahi, Worldwide, Volkswagen.
Helicopters. Like
Helicopteros. These all have held the same thing. And even in the Verdugo case that's cited in the footnote you were talking about, Judge Williams, if you look at Justice Kennedy's concurrence, he talks about the fact that Verdugo, the issue is the extraterritorial application of the Fourth Amendment, but says in his concurrence, all would agree, for instance, that the dictates of the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment protect the defendant when he is in a proceeding in an Article III court that is governed by the Constitution. So even in Verdugo, there was an understanding that the extraterritorial application was different from the Article III court exercising jurisdiction over someone, which does trigger.
There's legislation that's been upheld covering a wide range of activities, and I grant you they're criminal, but for example, aircraft piracy, various acts of terrorism by individuals who have no connection with or property or anything else here in the United States, as far as within the sovereign territory, no property, no presence, nothing. And yet, the courts have held that those individuals can be kidnapped and brought into the United States to face charges, and it's not a violation of due process to do that. How do you square that whole line of cases? I don't know if you're familiar with them, but there's a number of them, with the proposition that a foreign corporation has to have minimum contacts. If you blow a plane up and you're found in Cuba and brought here, you don't have any due process rights to say, hey, you brought me into this country against, you know. Noriega is another example.
Well, what I can point the court to is the Mwani case against bin Laden. It was a civil case, so it's different from the criminal context you're talking about. But in that case, the court analyzed the activities, which were a bombing that occurred in Kenya, and found that despite the fact the bombing occurred in Kenya, the ultimate sort of target of the terrorism was within the United States. And so it was reasonable that bin Laden or Al-Qaeda could assume that they would be hailed into a U.S. court to answer for their act of terrorism that was committed abroad. And it might be a similar analysis that applies in the context you're talking about, Judge Randolph. I think that's a far field from the actual limited issue that's before this court, which is whether under TMR Energy and under the BANSEC presumption, GSS did anything to overcome the presumption of separateness at the appropriate time, which was in responding to NPA's motion to dismiss. And it's important to remember that it was GSS's burden as the plaintiff trying to establish jurisdiction to provide facts and evidence to the district court to overcome that presumption if it intended to do so. It took a different litigation strategy. And as the district court noted in its Rule 59 motion, in its Rule 59 decision, sometimes there are consequences of failed litigation strategies. And here the consequence was that GSS did not articulate and present the court with evidence it would need to get out from within the holding of TMR Energy, that an instrumentality that is separate, that operates in an independent fashion, is entitled to due process protections.
You know that there are several nations abroad that have reciprocity rules on subjection of corporations which are foreign to them, mm-hmm. to their court's jurisdiction. Suppose that Congress, taking note of that, said, well, that's a good idea for us, and adopts a statute and implements such a rule. Now, would that be invalid as against a foreign corporation of a state that apparently is ready to exercise jurisdiction over U.S. corporations without regard to minimum contacts or anything?
I'm not aware, Judge Williams, of any circumstance in which Congress could enact a statute that would trump a constitutional
Well, that's the problem. Protection. That's the problem of characterizing all this as constitutional.
Well,
that's the problem of the extension of Bank Sec, which had nothing to do with judicial jurisdiction, to the context of judicial jurisdiction over foreign corporations or other entities.
Well, BANSEC did originally arise in the liability. It was a discussion in the liability context. In Foremost McKesson, this court said that the same analysis and the same presumption of separateness should govern jurisdictional inquiries.
Yes.
And in TMR Energy, it reiterated that same point from Foremost McKesson. So
undoubtedly.
I don't.
But that those cases get us into a mess, or gets Congress into a mess, if they are good law, right? Potential mess.
I don't know that the mess is any different than the mess that already exists from the fact that, and mess is your word, not mine.
It's a very formal judicial phrase.
Exists from the Asahi.
The statute defines an organization, an entity like your client as a state, right?
It falls within the definition of foreign state for the FSIA.
So here we have now, we have a congressional enactment that tells us what a state is. And Congress has some authority over, well, it remains to be seen what the Supreme Court will say, but some authority over foreign relations in terms of aid and so on and so forth. Whereas courts, we don't have any particular expertise in defining what a state is or what a state is not. And the Banco case really wasn't designed for the purpose of FISA. So why shouldn't it be that a court is required to defer to Congress's definition of what a state is? And if we do that, then we treat your client as part of Liberia, which is what the statute says we should do.
Well, I think a number of defendants, GSS has not raised that argument. A number of defendants in a number of cases have argued essentially that point, Judge Randolph. And what the courts have uniformly said is that whether or not someone is a foreign state for purposes of the FSIA has no bearing under the constitutional analysis of who is entitled to due process protections.
Why not?
Because a statute simply can't trump the Constitution.
Well, but that depends on what a state is, whether it's in fact trumping the Constitution or not. And that's the issue. And you know, we do this all the time when we're deferring to independent agencies. So why shouldn't we defer to, I just don't understand why we shouldn't defer to Congress on this. Yeah, well, you said it's a state. And besides that, it makes perfect sense because there's a reciprocity question like that Judge Williams raised that's lurking in the background of all these cases. You know, if you don't give us any kind of due process, we're not going to give your entities due process.
I think the reciprocity question actually cuts the other way, if I might suggest, Judge Randolph, that in BANSEC, one of the principles that the court articulated for underlying the rationale behind its decision was international law and how international law views corporations as separate entities, separate judicial, juridical entities from a parent, whoever that parent is. And in BANSEC, in articulating what it would take to overcome that presumption, what the court looked to was the private corporation context, and when courts can disregard a corporate form in the private corporation context, and then explain that those same principles should apply. So if a corporation is set up...
Once you constitutionalize this, to follow up on what Judge Williams says, then Congress, neither the Congress nor the executive really has any more role to play. But if in fact we defer to Congress on what the definition of a state is, then Congress can adjust that if there's retaliation.
The Congress only sets out the definition of a foreign state for purposes of the FSIA. Congress doesn't get to determine the definition of a foreign state for purposes of constitutional...
Well, isn't the bottom line that this panel has to defer to the previous panels? We have Foremost McKesson, we have Gilson, who have said exactly what you're saying, and maybe they're wrong, but if they are, that's for the other side to bring up an en banc or to go to the Supreme Court and ask for reversal. But this panel doesn't have authority whether it regards it as correct or not correct to diverge.
I agree, and I would suggest it would be too late to try and bring it up at an en banc when it has not been brought up in the motion to dismiss response, a Rule 59 motion, or an appellate brief. But yes,
well,
I agree, Judge Garland.
I'm not so sure about that. I mean, the basic argument is that here is that the Due Process Clause does not apply to this particular issue, exercising jurisdiction, federal court jurisdiction over a 100% state-owned corporation. And I mean, I'm not sure why that doesn't raise the issue.
Well, the issue is that there is a foreign corporation, and so GSS wants to look beyond the foreign corporation to who its parent is and have that influence whether or not there is personal jurisdiction. And this court has...
I'm sorry, you're going actually, it would seem to me, into the dropped issue as opposed to the issue that was presented.
My point was simply that a party can't use additional steps in a seeking judicial review to raise new arguments in a seriatim fashion. So, in conclusion,
well, I just want to get what you're saying on that. The argument is that NPA does not have the benefit of the Due Process Clause, right? And one formulation of that is to say that the Due Process Clause doesn't apply to 100% state-owned corporations, right? Is your point that GSS framed the argument more broadly?
Right. My point is that GSS has not asked this court to disagree with its holdings in Foremost McKesson or TMR Energy. It has suggested
that... Well, I don't know, but I'm not sure that you can quite say that, because that it certainly has asked for a ruling, which, on Judge Garland's statement, I think it's correct, requires... a reexamination of TMR.
I think that
it's TMR. If TMR puts the knife in their case, why doesn't that implicitly mean that TMR could be raised in an in-bank petition?
That is an argument for responding to an en banc petition.
I guess you could say you only need to worry about this on the assumption you win.
That is also true.
That's probably a good place to sit down.
So in conclusion, we ask that you affirm the judgment of Judge Friedman. Thank you.
All right. Did he have any other time? All right. We'll give you a couple more minutes. Go ahead.
Judge Randolph, to answer the question you raised, in their petition, the NPA did ask that the case be dismissed with prejudice because they had raised, in addition to the jurisdictional issues, many of the merits issues. And in its order, the district court did not dismiss with prejudice, simply dismissed because it was addressing only the jurisdictional issue. Having said that, I would urge the court that this is a narrow case if the matter is remanded for an adjudication of the true relationship between the NPA and Liberia. It's a narrow case if the court addresses what the standard, the due process standard, is. If we're right that it's not minimum contacts, but rather notice and opportunity to be heard, then there is no question that the FSIA meets that standard. And there is no risk here because the FSIA, as the court is aware, is a very special statute. It's directed only to foreign states and their agencies and instrumentalities. It's very prophylactic. It prevents prejudgment attachments. It permits post-judgment attachments only in the limited circumstances permitted by the Act. And that being the case, one must look at what is an arbitration award, what is a petition to confirm an arbitration award. Is it tantamount to an action to enforce a judgment? We say yes. If it is, then the appropriate due process standard is not minimum contacts because liability and damages have already been determined. And if that is the case, and if there is due process, then one must ask, is the FSIA permissible? And I think the answer to that must be yes. You don't get to minimum contacts if we're right about the nature of a petition to confirm an arbitration award. And it's only if you get past that, I suggest that the court would reach the ultimate issue, whether agencies or instrumentalities per se are not persons within the meaning of the Due Process Clause. And on that, our point is that if Liberia is not a person, then it can't beget a person.
So in other words, the
NPA.
Does the plaintiff ever have to have any kind of connection with the jurisdiction in which the plaintiff files the suit?
Under the FSIA, only if the jurisdictional prerequisites of the statute are met. There's the commercial activities.
Well, I don't know of any. I'm asking you. But if you know, it strikes me as strange that what the consequence, the upshot of your contention is that any wholly owned foreign corporation in the world can be sued in the United States by people who have no connection whatsoever with the United States.
Only, Your Honor, in the limited connection that arises here to enforce an arbitration award pursuant to an international convention. The New York Convention, the Convention on the Enforcement of Arbitration Awards, signed by over 150 countries, specifically permits actions to enforce arbitration awards.
And it's because the UK signed it that you have a right to seek enforcement here?
UK and the US, yes.
How about Liberia? Did Liberia?
Liberia has not signed it. But that's not an issue as to enforceability under the convention. Mm-hmm. But what this case is an enforcement of an arbitration award pursuant to an international convention, signed, as I say, by over 150 countries. And in that connection, we are simply not talking about minimum contacts. We're not talking about conventional cases.
Are there any of those cases that address, that arise in a situation where there's no evidence that there's any property in the United States to enforce against?
That doesn't arise under the FSIA. No, there are no cases
under
that
the arbitration that. For enforcing arbitration. Are there cases where you can confirm? It's not just enforce. You want to confirm an award, right?
Yes, the Glencore case I think is a good example to answer your question. In that case, it's a Ninth Circuit case. It's not an FSIA case. The court held that you had to have jurisdiction to enforce the arbitration award, and you did not have quasi interim jurisdiction absent property. Mm-hmm. And the court dismissed the case for lack of jurisdiction because there was no vehicle for service of process and there was no property. The FSIA, quite different. There is a vehicle for service.
Right, but I'm asking. So therefore, I guess I'm asking: under the FSIA, are there any cases, one way or the other, that address the question of?
No, there are not.
Either way,
there are not, and that is why we say the FSIA is different because it both extends jurisdiction, and it does so in a manner that is constitutionally fair.
So the next step, if you get the arbitration award confirmed, the next step. Is there anything in your complaint that indicates that this National Port Authority has any assets in the United States?
Well, it's the National Port Authority, Your Honor. It's part of Liberia. Liberia.
So I wondered about that. Why is it that then? Why don't you just sue Liberia?
Well, I think we have sued Liberia because I do think that is the shortest route to where we want to go. And I think it is open to us.
Is Liberia named in your complaint?
Not in this complaint, no. We filed a new complaint against Liberia.
Where?
In the district court.
And that's pending?
It is pending.
Was that assigned to Judge Friedman?
It was recently filed, Your Honor.
What does that mean? How recent?
Earlier this week. the prospect of arguing concentrates the mind.
Fair enough.
Fairly recent.
All right, thank you very much for the argument. Both sides will take the matter under submission.